The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 94.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've really looked forward to talking to. He is a rock star on FinTwit. His name is Tesla Charts. If you're not following him, you definitely need to right now. So, Mr. Charts, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thank you so much for having me, George. It's an unbelievable honor to be on your show. I've been a loyal subscriber to your channel for a very long time. I very much enjoy your videos, and it's a bit surreal to be a guest on your podcast. So I really appreciate the opportunity.
I appreciate the kind words. But I've listened to you quite often on our mutual friend Chris Irons' podcast, Quote the Raven. And you're one of my favorite guests for sure. But you've got a very interesting backstory as to kind of how you got involved this whole FinTwit thing in Tesla. Can you kind of walk us through that?
Absolutely. This is all sort of an accident and an unbelievable sort of series of events in my life. I'm not a finance person per se. I come from the corporate world. I'm a scientist by training, so I have a PhD in one of the hard sciences, and I was spent a couple of decades in corporate America, both doing research myself and then ultimately leading very large teams of technology experts. And I came to sort of the Tesla name at a change point in my career. I'd done well enough and had sort of thought about doing my own thing, and I was leaving corporate America, and I decided to start this Twitter account almost as an experiment. I decided that I would, you know, just start commenting on Tesla for a couple of years. I'd studied the company. My big realization that something was amiss with the company came back in 2016 when Tesla announced to the world that it had developed a solar roof technology. I happened to have a lot of experience in that space. I didn't really know much about Elon or the company. And then I watched him reveal this great product, and it occurred to me that nothing that he was saying was true. Right. So this is what I call the realization when Elon steps into your field and spews nonsense and suddenly you have to look at him differently. That happened to me very personally. I was anxious to see this new product and was curious about the specs. And then when he revealed it, I knew in the moment that it was almost certainly a fake product and wasn't real. And it's just one of those change your whole life, blow away moments where this person that's held up as sort of this genius and this innovator and this technology entrepreneur, and you see what they're doing for what it really is, and you just can't look at him or the company or any of their other technology proclamations the same way, and I haven't. So for about 2 years after that life-changing moment for me, I sort of had in the back of my mind that there's something very wrong with this company. I started studying it. And then I was simultaneously observing this sort of whole FinTwit phenomenon grow. I was a lurker on Twitter. And I have another passion in life, which is I'm very passionate about data and data visualization and how to sort of distill complexity into a really easy to understand chart that captures the essence of the underlying situation. And so when I put those two passions together and I just started Tesla Charts almost as a joke, I just wanted to get involved in the FinTwit community at this sort of changing point in my career and started my own business and decided it might be useful to get to know some people on Wall Street. And so I threw my hat in the ring and started tweeting on Twitter. The account predominantly in the beginning was about looking through Tesla's financials and sort of comparing what the media was saying about Tesla versus the underlying financial realities. That sort of captured the attention of some people on Twitter, and the account grew. But ultimately, the account sort of exploded after Elon himself came at me on Twitter and brought a lot of attention to the account because he was upset with some of the things that I was tweeting. And so the rest is kind of history. Here I am talking to George Gammon on YouTube. It's amazing.
Okay, but I want to be very clear. Prior to your kind of awakening, it's not like you were some climate denier, as they would say, or you're not some teenage hillbilly out there that's rolling coal with your buddies on any Prius that you can find at a local street corner in your diesel truck. You were very green, I guess, for lack of a better word, but you're very interested in electric technology with electric vehicles and with solar power. So I want to be very clear there. A lot of people think, oh, this guy's coming on, that he's just one of these rednecks that we see with, you know, that just doesn't care about the environment. And that's not true.
No, I'd spent the better part of my career researching alternative energy technologies, including solar cells. And I was very familiar with the solar roof concept. It's a seductive proposed solution to distributed power. I also just happen to know from experience that it is a very difficult problem to solve. And so when you hear that none other than the great innovator and brilliant genius Elon Musk has announced to the world that he has found a solution, you get excited. I was genuinely, I had a very positive impression of Elon and Tesla prior to that evening when I saw what I saw. And then also for the record, like the car that I drive every day is a Chevy Volt. It's a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. I think it's a fantastic solution to the problem of distributed pollution from automobiles. The vast majority of my driving miles are done on the battery, but if I ever run out of battery, I have a backup internal combustion engine, which removes range anxiety. It's a great platform. I'm disappointed that General Motors has canceled it. So I drive what is effectively an electric vehicle. I'm very much pro-environment. I do believe that capitalism left completely unregulated will fail to price in externalities of clean water, clean air, and the general sort of well-being of the planet. And so I do think there's a role for government in policing large corporations as they sort of participate in our society. And so actually it's quite the opposite. Like I happen to know a lot about the technologies of what are sort of viable, environmentally friendly alternatives to the current way in which we live. Big, very much proponents of them. And I think when you pervert those for your own personal financial gain, you actually do that entire vector a disservice. And so quite the opposite of being big oil, I come at this problem from personally offended at people taking advantage of society's desire to generate more value from the ESG movement for their own personal gain. And that's what I see going on today in the market, which is a lot of the Wall Street money types see this desire of most of society to do what they can to leave a better planet for their children and their grandchildren. And they just see that as just another money-making opportunity. And I believe that's what's actually going on with Tesla.
What do you think the real opportunities are in the space? Because for people who might be more interested in the fundamentals, and I'm not going to lump everyone together, but typically people who like to watch my channel are kind of anti-Fed, anti-quantitative easing. They like hard money, whether that's gold, silver, Bitcoin. Generally, those types of people are less about hype and more about, okay, well, where's the profit? And so within that space, where do you see real opportunities right now?
So I think it starts with how do you actually impact the individual civilian, you know, carbon footprint / environmental impact on the planet. And then all the true value that you might derive from that comes from there. And so if you actually, it's very simple type things like building a home with much more insulation, putting solar panels on your home, not necessarily in the form of a solar roof, but you know, with a very good sort of solid battery pack combined so that you can take advantage of the fact that, you know, the sun is the demand for electricity sort of scales with the sunlight in your area. I do think, for example, plug-in electric hybrid vehicles where, in my case, the first 50 miles that I drive are done on the battery. I rarely drive more than 50 miles in a day. I have personally eliminated 95%+ of my gasoline use while I still have a car that drives and it has 350 miles of total range because the internal combustion engine that's a backup to it kicks in after 50 miles and has 300 miles of range. And so I can drive on a highway trip and not have to worry about getting recharged on the battery on the rare times that I do a highway trip just by filling up at a gas station along the way. And so if you can cut 95% of your gasoline use and move most of it to the battery without giving up virtually, you know, you give up no other inconvenience relative to a full battery electric vehicle, I think that's a very sensible solution. And there is a legitimate environmental case for electric vehicles that is not very well articulated in the media. And that is the following. Even if my electric vehicle is predominantly powered by electricity produced at a coal plant, it's a lot easier to collect the pollution at a central point in a coal plant than it is to try to collect it from 200,000 vehicles spread all across the country. So the tailpipe is a more expensive solution to emissions like NOx and other things that might come out of a typical internal combustion engine. It's a lot easier to mandate that a coal facility, which is a point source, puts in scrubbers, does, you know, carbon capture and sequestration, and so on and so on. And so preparing society for the point where we are willing to regulate coal plants because now we have all these electric vehicles out in the fleet, that's a very positive thing. So there, my skepticism of Tesla is not a skepticism of electric vehicles or whether or not they are potentially a viable contributor to lowering the pollution of society overall. So if you ask me sort of big to small, insulation in homes, lighting, LED versus, you know, traditional light bulbs, that's a huge energy drawdown. Basically, if you put white roofs on most of the facilities, you could substantially reduce our energy use across the planet. There's so many more simple solutions to the problem than some of the more esoteric stuff that is being proposed today as being environmentally friendly. And so I my general sort of, I get offended when scientifically uninformed people are leveraging people's desire for a cleaner planet in a sort of malicious way for their own enrichment. And that's sort of what, where I came at this story. So quite the opposite of being a shill for big oil. I work for myself and I try to minimize my own carbon footprint. And I think deeply about technologies that might be viable. If every single home on the planet was retrofitted with better insulation, we would radically reduce our carbon footprint beyond what's possible, even with considering big changes in transportation.
That's really interesting. Yeah. And I always get a kick out of people that say, this guy's big oil or something like that. I remember when I first started the YouTube channel, a lot of the not a lot, but I'd have a few commenters here and there would say, oh, this guy is from the deep state. Don't listen to this guy. He's a plant. He's a plant. I used to look, text the comments to my sister and George, we'd just sit there and laugh and laugh.
If I was connected to Big Oil and they were paying me, you think I'd have a Twitter account? I would just be home cashing my check. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, so right now we've got some insanity going on in the markets with the valuations and what the retail, let's call them investor with quotes, using that term loosely, what they're buying right now, and just I would consider a complete mania. And I use Tesla occasionally in my videos, not really just to bash them or anything like this, because I don't understand it to the level that you do, of course. And I think their cars, I think they look pretty cool. They could be fantastic. I know they're amazing in the quarter mile. And I'm a big car guy myself, and I love fast cars. So I really appreciate what they do there. So I come at it from a standpoint, not necessarily that Tesla is a fraud, although I'd like to talk about that later, but more so that the price is just way, 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 way out of whack with the actual fundamentals. And I know that you're a student of markets and you're a student of fundamental analysis. So can you dive into why there's such a big disconnect, or how large the disconnect is between the actual fundamentals of the business and the current stock price?
Sure. And, you know, prior to the last couple of weeks, one could have imagined that Tesla was the poster child for the disconnect between what stocks are trading for, as you like to say, price versus value. I would say in the last month, we've seen Tesla as a piker compared to some of the things that are going on in the market today.
Yeah.
I mean, and we can
get into
all
that.
Of it.
I definitely want to get into that.
But if you just isolate Tesla, on a price to revenue basis, Tesla sells for about 30 times its competitors. And there's only so many reasons why that can be. So if you just look at the revenue and profitability of a Toyota or a General Motors versus the revenue, the volume of cars sold, and the lack of profitability at Tesla, it is undeniably true that Tesla stock is one of the most overvalued securities in the history of the stock market. Tesla's market cap enterprise value today is somewhere around the order of $200 billion. And its trailing 12 months revenue is on the order of $25 billion and shrinking. It's not a growth company. We could talk about the myths around Tesla in a bit. So Tesla sells roughly for 8 times revenue. And for an automaker, that's an absurd valuation. And so if you look at their peers, Honda, Toyota, General Motors, Nissan, they would all typically sell for 0.3 to 0.6 times revenue. Now, why do automakers grab such a low multiple? It's a terrible business. It's asset intense. It's low margin. It's very cyclical. It's susceptible to recessions. You have to spend an enormous amount of money on warranties and service because customers have come to expect excellence in all of their cars, even if you're buying the entry-level models. Rare is the automaker that earns its cost of capital across the cycle. And so if the very best automakers in the world are selling at 0.5 times trailing 12 months revenue. Why is Tesla selling at 8 times trailing 12 months revenue? Basically, order of magnitude plus higher than its peers. Well, it has to be that there's something different about Tesla. And so the Tesla bulls will tell you that Tesla is a technology company.
Or it's a
Tesla.
Data company. I hear that all the time. Just don't get it. You guys, you know, you bears, you just don't understand technology. You boomers. It's all about data, autonomous driving, robo-taxis. In 5 years, none of us will own a car. And every car in the United States will be a Tesla, all on their robo-taxi network, let's call it. And all that money will be piling into Tesla. And they're like Google. Or they're like Facebook. They're really a data company. They're not a car company.
That's all nonsense. So if I could leverage my net worth into betting against the reality of the projections, I would do it 100 to 1. And we can unpack it. So, but first of all, there's more to the bull case than just that. Actually, the bull case starts with electric vehicles are the future, and Tesla will dominate because they have a huge head start in batteries, in electric vehicle drivetrains.
That's and the all chargers, nonsense. Right? And they always talk about the charging network.
That's all nonsense, too. So in order to execute a stock promotion scheme, and I don't mean that in the legal sense, you have to have a story. You have to sell a story. You need a reason for why, as you said in your last video, which I loved, it's different this time. So if you're a Tesla bull, it's different this time, i.e. Tesla shouldn't be valued like a Toyota or a Honda or a GM because electric vehicles are going to dominate and Tesla's going to dominate the segment. And then when you mix in autonomous vehicles and data and all the other nonsense that they like to talk about, there's a different valuation that should be ascribed to the stock. And that's how you end up at 8 times revenue. And by the way, 8 times revenue for a company that has never turned an annual profit, that loses billions of dollars a year, and that is actually shrinking in revenue, which we can talk about. These are sort of the myths of Tesla.
Yeah, and one thing I want to just interject really quickly there to take it back to a level that I think everyone can understand, even if they're not sophisticated when it comes to analyzing financials and PEs and whatnot. Back in the day, before I retired, when I was an entrepreneur, I had experience buying and selling businesses and being in that world, and not big, huge businesses, but just normal businesses,
sure,
like gas stations, a laundry mats, maybe a liquor store or a marketing business, other things like that. But usually what we would look at is if a company was bringing down, let's say, $500,000 in profit a year, you'd be willing to pay maybe four times that.
Yeah.
So you'd be willing to pay like profit. So if they're bringing in, let's say, $1 million, to make the math easy, you'd be willing to pay about $4 million for that company that was bringing in $1 million profit. Now, their revenue could be $20 million. Or let's just say $10 million. But you're not going to give them $100 million. That is just complete craziness.
Yes.
So to take it down even further, that would be like buying a Circle K. Let's say that's making $100,000 in profit, but $1 million a year in gross. It'd be like paying $10 million for a Circle K, like on the corner. That's putting it into perspective. Now, of course, the argument's going to be that Circle K, they're all geniuses, and they're going to dominate all the other liquor stores by 2025. And it's not a liquor store. It's a data company, and it's an autonomous liquor store, Mr. Charts. Get it right.
Yes, yes. The liquor just shows up at your couch.
Yeah.
On command. In fact, you don't even have to order, because the neuro interaction between your brain knows exactly when you want to drink, and it pours it for
right.
you.
The AI. It's got AI. Right. So the
yes.
AI and will determine when you want your beers.
And there's also a blockchain play there somewhere as well. But in all seriousness, you're 100% right. So why would you pay more than sort of a multiple of revenue for a company? There's a couple of reasons why you might. And there are legitimate reasons why you might. So you would pay a multiple of revenue for WhatsApp if you knew that Facebook was going to buy it for $19 billion, right? But broadly speaking, sort of back to sort of generalities, you would pay for a company well above its current annual revenue, let alone profit, if the following two things were true. It was growing incredibly fast, and it was extraordinarily high margin. So if you can present to me a $1 million a year business that's growing at 75% and it has 80% gross margins,
right,
you could genuinely come up with a net present value valuation model that ascribes it a multiple of revenue that's worth paying. Tesla is not growing. It hasn't actually grown quarterly sales since Q3 2018 to any degree. It's going to shrink again big time in Q2, both sequentially and year over year. And people will say, oh, well, COVID. I get it. But this is a company priced for perfection, not for excuses.
Mm-hmm.
And they only have, you know, two production facilities, one in California, one in China. So, yes, they're giving share in Europe, but they don't have a plant in Europe. Why is this company worth $200 billion? They can't service the market in Europe, and Volkswagen and Audi and BMW are eating their lunch over in Europe right now. So I find it baffling that a company priced for more than perfection has a legion of backers that are more than willing to come up with lots of excuses for why the numbers are disappointing. On top of that, they're not growing. They lose money. They're not a profitable business. They do lots of accounting tricks to show GAAP or non-GAAP profit once in a while. But you can't find me a four-quarter period where the company has shown a positive GAAP profit in the 17 years that it's been around. It just, in fact, Elon Musk has not been CEO of any company that has shown an annual profit ever.
You know, another thing I find fascinating, and I first noticed this way before, in fact, before I retired, and it was just, I don't know how I noticed it, but it was when everyone on Wall Street was using BlackBerries. So, I don't know, what was that, 2010, 2011, something like that. And I remember everyone around me that worked for me at the time, I probably had 100 employees. Everyone, you know, I'd travel all over the United States, and everyone had an iPhone. I mean, everybody. So I remember looking at the stock, I think it was called RIM, and thinking to myself, how on earth has this thing not come down? And then I went to New York. I went to Wall Street, not the stock exchange, but Wall Street there. And I noticed all the traders, all the guys that, and gals that were there, you know, in the mix, they all had BlackBerries. And it dawned on me, I'm like, I'll bet you they're just all the money, they, all the hedge fund guys talk to one another, all the private equity, or whomever's doing the bulk of the buying, they all use BlackBerries. So they're thinking that the price is cheap. But when in reality, nobody outside of New York or Washington, D.C. is using it. I think it could be the same type of psychology with Tesla, because whenever I'm online, you see all the bulls tend to be in California, Oregon, Washington. And sure enough, if you go to California, yeah, everybody's driving a Tesla. So it's very easy to extrapolate that and say, my gosh, everyone in the world is driving a Tesla. Look at my neighborhood. There's a Tesla in every single driveway. But what they don't realize, if they just go, if they go one state over or go into a farm town or maybe another country, that no one's even heard of Tesla. Now, of course, not in the United States, but if you go to a country like Colombia, in fact, I'm here. And another quick fun story is they have a day of the year, a couple days, where they don't allow gas vehicles to drive on the road. So I remember I was jogging on that day, and one of the cops had pulled over a Tesla. And you don't see them here at all in Colombia. But the owner was having the hardest time getting out of the ticket because he's trying to explain to the cop that the car was actually electric, and the cop didn't believe him because he didn't even know what a Tesla was.
Yeah. Right? Let me yes and you. So yes, I agree that if you're in California or you're on the East Coast and you're in a wealthy community, all you see are Teslas, and you might be thinking that this is the future. On top of that, what we're seeing on Wall Street is Wall Street needs vehicles of a different kind to drive trading activity and take advantage of uninformed retail investors on Wall Street. And Elon is a CEO who's willing to play that game. Mm. And so are some of the others. And so you have this sort of nexus. And by the way, I should say up front, I've been dead wrong on the stock. Being short Tesla has been a terrible idea. I've lost money shorting Tesla. All the people on Twitter who say stock price bro to me are correct. I wouldn't recommend shorting Tesla. Nothing is investment advice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I know what Tesla's worth, and it's not anywhere near $1,000 a share, which is what it's trading hands for today on the stock market. I know what the value is. The price, I've gotten 100% wrong. The value, I know I'm right. But what we're seeing today in the stock market, and maybe this is sort of a way to generalize the conversation beyond Tesla, is there's this amazing lack of, I think, oversight by the SEC, very permissive environment for fast and loose rules, things that you and I would never have imagined doing 10, 15 years ago are basically going on everywhere you look, and people are raising money on, we're basically going to cheat retail investors out of their cash because we have the next big thing that we can sell and unload onto bag holders. Right. And we're seeing it, like just the Hertz situation itself. Mm. Could you imagine?
Yeah, walk everyone through that might not understand the actual dynamics, what's going on there, just a transfer of wealth from the kids or whomever's buying the equity to the bondholders.
So it's a long story, but I'll start it with what is Hertz. Hertz is a rental car company. We all know it. Business travelers know it. The rental car business is hyper-competitive, asset intense, low margins, not a really good business. Hertz itself was sort of acquired and reacquired and levered up in the sort of standard private equity type corporate machinations that go on in what I consider to be dying businesses. So long before COVID hit, Hertz was a low margin, very levered, struggling business that rented cars to travelers. And when COVID happened, the business went away. I mean, COVID has devastated a whole swath of businesses and has created a bunch of zombie companies that are still around and trading today because of the largesse of the Fed. Right. We can argue whether or not that's good for the long term. I think it's distinctly bad, but it is what it is. It's today's reality. So Hertz filed for bankruptcy. Why did Hertz file for bankruptcy? The predominant reason why Hertz filed for bankruptcy is the business was hemorrhaging cash. It had all of these fixed costs and no revenue coming in. It was a bad business before COVID. It's a fiasco business post COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hertz had a terrible balance sheet. It had something like $16 billion of debt tied to the assets of the rental fleet. So in other words, they had pledged the rental cars as collateral for loans to finance the business. And that's very common. It's called ABS, asset-backed securities. But they also had $4 or $5 billion worth of real debt, unsecured by anything in the business, that they couldn't make the interest payments on because the business went away. Look, this is no fault to Hertz. COVID destroyed their business. This is what happens. I suspect, even in a post-COVID world, we're going to need a lot less rental cars because people aren't going to travel because they've learned Zoom and they've learned how to work remotely and they've learned how to get things done without having to travel. So Hertz did the normal, typical thing that happens when a company can no longer service its debt. It filed for bankruptcy protection. Turns out most of the times when you file for bankruptcy, the stock goes to zero. Why? Because during the bankruptcy proceedings, all the bondholders have to get made whole before any old equity holders see a penny.
Right.
But in the Robinhood era, a bunch of day traders spending their, you know, Trump bucks, as we call it on FinWit, have decided that they're going to buy and sell Hertz shares back and forth to each other and bid them up in a what can only be described as a mania. And the Hertz debt holders who are currently in bankruptcy court, seeing what's going on with the old shares that are almost certainly worthless, have petitioned the court to sell residual unissued shares from the old company to these people who have no idea what they're buying to recover more money for the debt holders. And it's a sort of a nuance of Wall Street. And I know, you know, your whole channel is about educating people about what actually happens on Wall Street and in finance. This is a real education for a lot of people. I think it's really amazing. There's almost zero chance that the stock currently being sold, new stock currently being sold by Jefferies, which is the investment bank that's leading the at-the-market offering of these unused Hertz shares. There's almost no chance those shares are going to be worth anything. And yet people on Robinhood are lining up to pay $2.50, $2, $1.80 for these shares that will eventually get zeroed out as part of the bankruptcy proceedings. And here's the proof. You can buy a bond in Hertz today that has basically priority over that equity that's being sold for 45 cents. Before the equity sees a penny, that bond needs to be made whole. I can look up on my Bloomberg terminal right now a Hertz bond, unsecured. It's selling for 45 cents. If the equity had any hope, that bond would be selling for par or close to it. It'd be selling for a dollar, not 45 cents. There's 4 billion of those notes. And if you just look at the value that the bond market is ascribing to those notes, it would put a negative value on the equity of, say, minus $2 billion. So what's going on right now is basically, in my opinion, I think it's totally wrong. I think it shouldn't have been allowed to happen. The Hertz debt holders are legally overtly stealing money from uninformed retail investors.
Right.
And here's the analogy I would use. The way they get around it, the legal loophole, they say, is we don't yet know how the bankruptcy process is going to unfold, and it's not yet certain that equity would be zero.
Okay. So the question then becomes, if we go back over the last 20 years, how many times has a publicly traded company filed for bankruptcy and the equity not gone to zero?
It's rare. It happens.
Okay.
But not with the situation like this. It can happen where things change and circumstances are such that there's money left over for equity holders. And in fact, it's not uncommon for equity to get something. It's typically called nuisance value to make everybody sign up for the final, you know, negotiated package, and the new company's going to come out of bankruptcy with new stock. You might get 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 cents a share in nuisance value.
Okay.
But what's going on with Hertz is completely different. And let me give it to you in an analogy that I posted on Twitter that I think will resonate with your audience.
Yeah.
I'm going to put my hand in this register, and I'm going to grab as much cash as I can. It's not my cash. I'm a customer at a store. I'm at Home Depot, and they've opened the cash register. I'm going to throw my hand in that register, and I'm going to grab as many bills as I can. And then I'm going to walk out of this store. Now, since I don't know for sure that I might not drop a couple of dollars on the way out, I can't say with certainty that I'm stealing or how much I've stolen. But that is effectively what's going on with Jefferies and the Hertz debt holders. They see idiot retail investors who don't know what they're doing. They see the stock being bid up by the Davy Day Trader global types and all the people that follow them and all of the high frequency traders that are front running those trades. And they say, hey, we have over here 247 million shares of Hertz that we never issued. The stock is trading for a couple of bucks a share. Our hold might be $5 or $6 billion, but if I could sell that 250 million shares for $2 a share, I could steal $500 million from idiots and give it to the bondholders. And that's what they're doing. And it's overt. It's right in their, it's right in their perspective that the issue today. It is historic. It is unprecedented. It is insane. I can't believe it's happening. On the flip side, somebody else DM'd to me, hey, the quicker this $500 million gets pulled out of dumb money and into smart money's hands, the quicker we're going to resolve this mania. Because that's what they're doing.
Yeah, it's always capital goes where it's treated best.
It's insane.
It's unfortunate, but that's why you see all these people who win the lottery, as an example, and 2 years later, they're completely broke. It's no surprise at all. And just to be clear, too, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not just Hertz. It's Chesapeake. It's JCPenney. I mean, there's a few companies that have filed bankruptcy where, let's call them the Robin Hood types or the Portnoy, Mr. Portnoy and his whole crew, that they're piling into as well, correct?
Well, Chesapeake has not yet filed for bankruptcy, but there's serious reporting that they intend to.
Okay.
And many of the stocks that have either filed for bankruptcy or almost certainly will have taken off, which is really a perversion. But actually, the Hertz precedent is really important.
Okay.
And I put a tweet out that Zero Hedge picked up and reposted over the weekend. If I'm the board of Chesapeake and I have unissued shares that I've already registered with the SEC sitting on a shelf, why would I not sell all of those the day before I file for bankruptcy to get as much money as possible from people who don't know what they're doing? Because, in fact, I would argue they now have a fiduciary to. The Hertz precedent has been set. So if I'm Chesapeake and I'm about to file for bankruptcy and I have a billion shares that are sitting there unissued that I could take to the market and try to sell to uninformed retail investors, even if I got 10 cents a share for them, that's $100 million that I didn't have before. And why would I just leave $100 million on the floor? So the Hertz situation is, I think, a terrible precedent. And what you're going to see is board members on companies that should file for bankruptcy are going to view it as their fiduciary to extract every last penny from the market before they file. It's clear now. We have a precedent. You can take shares of stock that you know in your heart are worth zero. You know that I'm not going to drop a dollar bill as I'm running out of the Home Depot after putting my hand in that register. I might. It's theoretical. It's possible. So we can't say with certainty whether or how much I stole. But for all intents and purposes, every dollar bill I grab out of that register is stolen. The literal interpretation of the law, the loophole that Hertz found because of this Robin Hood, David Portnoy frenzy around the Hertz stock, I think is a terrible precedent. And it's going to result.
It goes back to the Fed, too.
Of course.
I mean, it just goes back to the Fed and unintended consequences. And that's why we're all human beings. And I don't care how many PhDs are at the Fed. Let's just assume for a moment their intentions are good. They just cannot see the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth effect of keeping interest rates at almost zero for 12 years and taking their balance sheet to $7 trillion. And what I mean by that is if they're taking interest rates this low, then you can't get a return anywhere. So these businesses go further and further out the risk curve. They buy back their shares. They do all these things. And the retail investor, let's buy the dip. We got a Fed put, So that's what creates this environment. So I want to focus on the symptoms, but I also really want to focus on the cause, which in my opinion is the Fed and, of course, unintended consequences. But that takes us to the next topic.
Well, let me yes and you again. It's not just the Fed. It's an incredibly permissive regulatory environment that originates at the SEC. And to circle back to what we started with, which is Tesla, if Elon Musk can fake a buyout offer on Twitter that didn't exist during the trading day and keep his job as CEO and be heralded as a genius and the stock doubles from there, I also believe it's not just the Fed. It is Jay Clayton and the SEC basically saying there are no rules. You can fake a buyout offer on Twitter. Then you could go on CBS and tell the world that you do not respect the SEC. He was on 60 Minutes. Elon Musk was. And right. I'm not going to follow my settlement, and I'm going to flip the bird to the SEC. The SEC used to be an institution that corporations and hedge funds and money managers alike feared. That's no longer the case. And so I believe it's not just the Fed. The Fed is certainly necessary but not sufficient. You couldn't have what's going on with Hertz today if you also didn't have a very compliant SEC that basically said fraud is okay, fraud creates alpha, it's a casino out there, every person for themselves, we're not going to protect the little guy. For the SEC to not intervene and even just invent a reason to intervene to slow down this Hertz fiasco tells me just how permissive the environment is. And if you don't have the fear of the police, you know, defunding the investment police effectively.
Yeah, right.
The SEC is funded, but they're not doing anything. Like just last week, the SEC busted some guy in California for making $137,000 of illicit profits by buying a company, promoting it on some message boards, and then selling it into the strength. $137,000.
Right.
But we're allowing Hertz to go and steal effectively $500 million or more from retail investors to give it to bondholders and lawyers and everyone else, consultants in the bankruptcy case. That $500 million is going to get wiped out in the fees and the vultures that have circulated Hertz. It's insane. But the SEC proudly tweeted 10 days ago about how they busted some guy in California for making $137,000 day trading in his personal account. I don't think that that guy who made $137,000 should be let off the hook. I would never do it. I don't approve it. But are we really, like, this is what the SEC is doing? And so when you just look at the utterly permissive regulatory environment in the current administration, combined with free money, ZIRP absurdity, zero interest rate policy, no dip can't be bought. Even today, as we're recording this, the market went down 5-7% last couple of days. The Fed comes out and says they're going to buy corporate bonds and the market rallies. Like, no stocks are allowed to go down. The Fed plus a very permissive SEC leads to some of the shenanigans that we're seeing, including, I think, picking of the pockets of retail investors by the Hertz debt holders.
This podcast is sponsored by my friends at Capitalist Exploits, one of the few research letters I read myself. If you want more information on how this powerful tool can help you become a better investor, plus get a 15% discount, check out our affiliate link. We'll put it right in the show notes page. What do you think about the attitude of the SEC right now being tied to the fact that over the past 10 years especially, and I'd go probably back 20, even 30 years, but especially the last 10 years since the Fed has gotten into quantitative easing, and our economy has become so financialized. And Luke Gromen says this very well. The economy now is the stock market, meaning that if the stock market goes down, it has a huge impact on spending and the actual real economy. So because of these distortions, in the real economy and the financial economy. Do you think the Fed, first and foremost, and then maybe the SEC understand this, in this meaning that we have to prop up the stock market, because if the stock market comes down, the whole house of cards, the whole economy comes crashing in. They know that. So they're like, listen, normally we'd go after this guy, we'd go after that guy, but right now we can't, because we have to put the greater good of the economy ahead of the law.
100%. And in fact, if you just take that further, first of all, I agree completely. If stocks go down, pension funds tip over.
Right.
Cities are already struggling. Municipalities are already struggling with COVID and the lack of, you know, commercial buildings not being able to, if you can't collect rent from your tenants as a commercial building, how can you pay your local and state taxes?
And taxes. I was going to say, and taxes, yeah. Mr. Charts, the thing that really gets impacted on a recession or depression are taxes.
So municipal bonds, pensions, the Chicago, you think the Chicago Teachers Union pension is in any good shape right now? So if pensions, if stocks go down, it is the domino that knocks everything down. So to an extent, I can sympathize with the Fed and the SEC for the stance they've taken. Because they can't, like, for example, when the SEC settled with Tesla, I think Jay Clayton set a terrible precedent, which was basically, we can't really sanction Elon for committing what I think is one of the most overt and consequential examples of securities fraud in the history of the stock market, faking a buyout offer in the middle of the trading day on Twitter. We can't really go after Elon because that would tank Tesla's stock and that would hurt Tesla shareholders.
Well, and teachers unions.
Yeah. And, you know, the government owns it and blah, blah, blah. What a terrible precedent. So what you've effectively said when you've done that is you've given a green light to criminals and a green light to fraudsters and a green light to people that are smart enough to see that the Fed and the SEC can't do anything but enable my fraud. And so, of course, I'm going to take full advantage of it. I'm going to press my bets. I'm going to borrow money, lever up, and put all my chips in the middle, because the only thing you have to do to make sure that the Fed and the SEC protect you is become too big to fail.
Yeah, or not even too big to fail, too important.
Yes.
From a standpoint of the general public or the local union or you know, to fail. So if you're a fraudster, then all you have to do is just go to CalPERS and just entice them any way you can to invest in your company, and then you just rape and pillage.
100%. And it's not even that hard, George. Like, all I have to do is convince enough retail people to buy me. Like, it is the ultimate perversion of capitalism. So, you know, and I'm on Twitter. I see all kinds. I see the political left, the political right. This isn't capitalism. This is a ruination of capitalism through cronyism. It's an orgy of corruption, criminality, and cronyism that I worry is the beginning of the downfall of the entire sort of system that we've benefited from and that we love. And part of my passion for starting Tesla Charts and for being involved in Twitter and the privilege of talking to people like you is there are real voices out there that say, like, this is wrong. Yeah. Like, this isn't going to work. In the long run, the crowd is going to show up for all of us with guillotines if we don't get this right. Like, the disparity in wealth in this country is disturbing. I'm a relatively wealthy person. You're relatively well off. We both have lives and jobs that have persisted through COVID. I'm very blessed. I worked very hard. I'm very proud of my accomplishments in life. But at the same time, I also know that I'm very privileged, and I'm worried about the pillaging and the raping of everybody in society for the benefit of the very few, even if I'm one of the beneficiaries. This is not sustainable. This is not healthy. This is not going to last.
Yeah, and what's terrible about it is the only tool the Fed has at their disposal will exacerbate the problem of social unrest. Because if the social unrest is, number one, food prices going up, let's say, and then the wealth inequality, if the only tool you have is quantitative easing in ZERP or NERP, then it just gets worse and worse. Therefore, the social unrest will most likely get worse and worse. But before we go down that rabbit hole, I want to go back and talk about Nikola, because this is a company that I didn't even know exists until, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks ago, something like that. And I couldn't believe it. Like I was stunned. First and foremost, I couldn't even believe their name. Like, are you kidding me? Like really? Like you're going to blatantly rip off Tesla. It's like you're not even trying, right? You're obviously looking at Tesla, seeing all the retail that piles money into that name, and then just riding on their coattails to try to bring in as much money as you can and then cash out after 6 months. And then who cares? You got a great story maybe, but I mean, if they were a serious company, don't you think they would have tried to come up with a little bit different name? And I know that's not very analytical, but my goodness, tell us about this company.
Yeah, Nikola has been around for a long time. They've been on my radar for a long time. Trevor Milton is the CEO. And I think there's a deeper story here, George, and I appreciate the opportunity to express it with you and maybe, you know, hash it out a little bit. So the first thing you need to learn about Nikola is, how did they come to the market? So the traditional route that a startup with ambition, with new technology, and Nikola, for the benefit of the audience that may not know, is a startup company that desires to build long-haul trucks, you know, tractor-trailer, 18-wheeler type trucks that are powered by hydrogen gas, fuel cells, alternative technologies that are clean. And it's a fair sort of classic thing, back to our earlier discussion about environmental impact. If you could sort of solve emissions from long-haul trucking, you would do a significant benefit to our overall global warming, carbon footprint, the sort of impact on the planet. But I don't think that's what they're trying to do. But anyway, the way Nikola came to market, the traditional way you would do it is you would do an IPO. You would do a roadshow. You would put together a prospectus. You would do your roadshow on Wall Street, and the banks would say, okay, this is what we think we could take you to the market at, and so on and so on and so on. Nikola didn't do that. The way Nikola became a publicly traded company last Monday was through a reverse merger into what's called a SPAC. And I don't know if you've discussed SPACs on your podcast before.
No, I have no idea what that means.
Yeah, so a SPAC is a special purpose acquisition company that exists to go find targets to buy and then become publicly traded. This is, you know, so if one of my favorite accounts on Twitter that I follow is Muddy Waters, and he exposed a bunch of Chinese reverse merger frauds 10 years ago, and they're still on the stock market today. The old way that you would do this is you would go find some dormant company that's bankrupt but still listed on the pink sheets. You would reverse merge into that company. Suddenly you're listed on the pink sheets. You would get an auditor to sign off on your accounting, and then you would apply to be listed on the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange. And, you know, you might find some old dormant sports bra company that doesn't exist anymore. You would reverse merge into it as, you know, Georgian Tesla Charts Battery Co. And we would then get listed. We'd publicly trade. We'd get our financials signed off, and then we would apply for listing on the QQQ or the New York Stock Exchange. That's a very fishy way to do it, and lots of people have sussed this out, and they know that, generally speaking, that's sort of like there's a high correlation of fraud-type stock promotion schemes and reverse mergers that try to get listed by skipping the IPO. Wall Street invented SPAC, Special Purpose Acquisition Vehicle, as sort of a country club blessed version of the reverse merger scam. Now, the vast majority of SPACs aren't scams. I'm not saying that Nikola is a scam. I'm just saying if Nikola did a traditional IPO like WeWork tried to do, like Uber did, like Lyft did, it would be a different story. Now, they didn't. They basically merged with a SPAC. Now, why is that sort of questionable from the beginning? Well, first of all,
yeah, and what would their motivation be to do that?
To get listed quickly. So the SPAC is already trading. So Nikola, until last Monday, the company that is now Nikola was VTIQ. That was the symbol. It was a special purpose acquisition company set up and funded by the likes of BlackRock and Larry Fink and all of these sort of ESG crowd that are looking for stocks to basically promote as being environmental, social, and governance qualified. I like to refer to ESG as environmental and socially gullible. because you know, they're not actually achieving the mission, but they have the perception of it. Nikola merged with a SPAC called VTIQ. They changed the name and the ticker to NKLA, and that's what's trading on the stock market today. In so doing, the previous shareholders of Nikola before that merger are sharing the pie with the VTIQ shareholders of the SPAC long before this entity combined. And so if you were truly sitting on what you think is breakthrough technology that's going to revolutionize the world and impact the environment, why wouldn't you just take the time to go through an IPO, do it your own way, and keep all the pie for yourself? So right away, there's a bit of a red flag. Now, again, I don't want to cast aspersions on SPACs generally, but it is an atypical way in which startup companies become publicly traded. And, you know, happy to come back on and talk to you about it in more detail as you learn about it after this conversation. But broadly speaking, SPACs are also pro-cyclical. What does that mean? You tend to see more of them at the end of bull markets because everybody that's sort of informed knows that the music's going to stop pretty soon. We got to get these things onto the market as quickly as possible. Right. So if you have a way to quickly become publicly traded and on top of that, circumvent the traditional disclosures and the sort of hardcore assessment that you might have to do if you're going to be an IPO. For example, if WeWork had gone to market via a SPAC as opposed to trying to do the traditional IPO, they might have made it. They didn't. They exploded on the launch pad, and now SoftBank's sitting on all of these losses. You know, the bubble was burst because the S1 of the WeWork IPO exposed really what the business was, and it didn't get past even cursory inspection. None of that happened with Nikola, because Nikola reverse merged into a pre-existing entity that was already trading on the public stock markets and became NKLA by basically changing the name and the ticker of a pre-existing publicly traded company. So the SPAC that bought Nikola went public less than 2 years ago, and these SPACs have a very interesting attribute to them, which is if they don't find a target to buy, they have to give their money back to investors in a certain period of time, usually 2 years or 18 months or some sort of standard period of time. And so if Tesla Charts and George SPAC Co. went public and we raised $200 million from investors to say, we're experts in YouTube financial media oriented podcasts and we want to go acquire the next Joe Rogan.
Right.
We would get $200 million. We'd have to put it in basically the equivalent of an escrow account. And then we've got 2 years to go find the next Joe Rogan. So we might say, we're going to go buy QTR. We're going to merge into the private company that is QTR. And then, you know, TC, you know, George Gammon Co., ticker TCGG, is going to merge into QTR. And we're going to start trading on the New York Stock Exchange as QTR. And we're going to sell the future revenues of QTR sponsors using the Joe Rogan comp as a potential future story. And then all the investors of both QTR and, you know, TCGG are going to basically have access to the public markets without having to have QTR going through the traditional IPO roadshow. Right. And that's what's happened with Nikola. And I know it's a bit complex. I don't want to dive too much into the details, but that nuance is really important to explain, I believe, in part, what's going on with Nikola and sure.
How much did that special purpose vehicle, or for lack of a better term, pay for Nikola?
Well, it was a merger. So it was sort of a cashless transaction. Basically, okay. the two entities combined, the working capital of both companies combined, the you know ownership of the new entity is a negotiation between the two sides. But the Nikola shareholders and the VTIQ shareholders in this case combined forces and then became Nikola, the trading vehicle that we're now seeing trading on Wall Street today. And okay. There's even more nuances towards it. Like, for example, there's a huge arbitrage because there's Nikola warrants that trade today publicly, NKLAW, that seem to trade at a significant discount to Nikola, even though you can, in a very short period of time, exchange them for Nikola shares. This is a whole new frontier. It's blowing up. It's pro-cyclical. It's the kind of thing you see at the end of a bull market, per your video on the sort of 2020 stock market and the signs of a mania. What you're seeing is all of the smart money sees that the music is stopping and they're looking for their chairs.
Yeah, right.
And a SPAC is a great way to find a chair really quick,
mm-hmm.
is the way I look at it. Okay. And so that's how they got to market. So like WeWork failed, blew up on the launchpad. Nikola didn't, because they had a pre-existing vehicle that traded on the stock market that they reverse merged into. They called it Nikola, and now it's exploded. So if you invested in the SPAC, the VTIQ SPAC, the price you paid for that stock is $10. Nikola's trading for $66, $67 today. So already, although they can't sell because they have a lockup period, you're looking at a 600-700% return on your money. Why wouldn't you be interested in investing in a SPAC if you knew that they could pull off a merger, especially if the company has ESG credentials?
Right.
And so if you know all of that in advance, why wouldn't you just decide that you have ESG credentials, create a story around it, sell it to Wall Street, everybody gets on board, we're going to go ahead and fleece Robinhood one more time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like putting .com at the end of your name in the late 90s. And
or crypto, you know, three years ago. It's the same thing.
Okay. So let's go into the company. Do they have revolutionary technology? I read somewhere that they have 4 employees.
I think they have more employees than that.
Okay.
So I would preface this by saying I've spent far less time studying Nikola than I have Tesla.
Right.
And I'm not an expert, but I see the very same behavior of Trevor Milton and Elon Musk.
Well, there's nothing to study with Nikola. They don't even have a product. They don't have revenue. What do you study, Mr. Charts?
You study the behavior of the CEO and what he has learned. So this is back to, you know, the problems with a permissive SEC and loose monetary policy combining to reward stock promotion. Right. So I see Trevor Milton on Twitter today picking fake fights with shorts just for polarity, just to be out there. He's going to be on, as we're recording this, I'm not sure you know, you probably don't. I'm turning around and I'm looking at Mad Money on my TV here. And guess who the guest is on Mad Money tonight?
Oh, you're kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding you. This is a classic, I'm going to replicate the playbook of Elon Musk. I can't say that all the other attributes of the two companies are the same, but Nikola has no revenue and undiluted had a value of over $20 billion today. Never mind no profit, like you said in your video, no revenue.
Yeah, they don't even have a product. Like they don't have a car. They don't have a truck. They don't even have a concept to like show people.
Well, they have prototypes.
Oh, do they? Okay. Okay.
But they don't have a factory. They don't have a manufacturing agreement that I know of. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure they don't. But what they do have is a story. They have a story and they have a ticker and the ticker trades. And if you have a story and you have a ticker and you're willing to say things that most respectable business people wouldn't say, given their inherent respect for securities laws and potential risk of enforcement against you, you can make a lot of money. And if you're an investor in the SPAC, all you need is a CEO willing to do that. None of the investors in the SPAC or the investors in Nikola are taking any chances. It's just the CEO. He sold into the IPO, basically into the merger agreement that gave birth to Nikola. So he took some money off the table, which is unusual.
Oh, I thought you weren't allowed to do that. There was a lockup period.
Well, you're not allowed to sell bankrupt shares. You know what I mean? If you disclose what you're doing and people say that's fine with me, then are you not allowed to? I mean, traditionally, you wouldn't be allowed to monetize any of your stake until after the IPO and everyone had a chance to see your company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's traditional. I mean, we're far beyond what is considered. In fact, perversely, we're rewarding non-traditional behavior because everybody wants to get on board, right? And so the Titanic may be sinking, but I've got a really good seat, you know, at the orchestra. And so he did sell into the IPO, and he even commented on Twitter, you know, and he has a story. But it, you know, it's just the sign of the times. And so all you really need today is a symbol that trades on Robinhood and the ability to become a story stock that the Robinhood types and David Day Trader and Wall Street Bets get behind. And then the mania takes care of itself. And worse than that, I think what we're seeing is there's a real story here. It's look, we could talk about David Day Trader and Nikola and Hertz because they're all related.
Yeah.
What we're seeing is the retail influx of day traders that have hit the market, which is utterly pro-cyclical and top tick, you know, in the history of stock market manias. It's always that, as you so brilliantly laid out in your video. But it's worse than that. It's magnified by the fact that Robinhood is selling its order flow to high-frequency traders.
Right.
And so there's a reason why high-frequency traders are paying 10 times the cost of traditional order flow at Robinhood. And it's not because they're charities. It's because they see extraordinarily high value in what Davy Day Trader's army is shoving their money at today. Now, there's some suspicion that maybe they're actually overtly front-running trades. I don't think that's necessary. If you just knew in advance what the next Robinhood mania stock would be, you'd make a killing. Mm. Right. If I could have told you when Hertz was at 40 cents a share that the Davy Day Trader crowd was going to pick Hertz to be the next thing that everyone piles into, and you quietly built a position in Hertz, you'd be rich today.
Right. And most people don't realize that they think they're getting free trades.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, this is a miracle. We're getting free trades. Yeah, no, you're not getting free trades.
George, it with every social media platform, if it's free, you're not the customer, you're the product.
That's right. Great. Well said.
And so all of the Robinhood traders are the product that Robinhood is selling to the Citadels of the world. And there's a reason why the Citadels of the world are paying top dollar for that order flow. And it's not nefarious. It's not innocent. It is a nefarious explanation. It is de facto money being extracted from poor to wealthy people.
Yeah.
And the topic, so if I look at this, the sort of overarching synthesis of all of your videos, it's a cry for help that says the explosion of wealth inequality in our society is net bad, even for the wealthy, and this needs to stop. And everywhere you look, it's a perversion of capitalism. It's cronyism, it's criminality, it's fraud, whether overt or blessed by the regulators. None of it ends well. And I love the country. You love the country. I count us both as patriots. I love America. I'm an immigrant to the country. I'm so passionate about it. I started Tesla Charge because of what I saw, what I thought was substantial wrongdoing. To be totally fair to Elon, it pales in comparison to what we're seeing in the rest of the market today in this mania blow off. Like, he's nowhere near the worst actor anymore. And in fact, in some ways, he probably figures he's too early to the game. You know, he IPO'd the traditional way back in 2009 or whatever it was. He didn't reverse merge into a SPAC. Like, he has factories and he has, like, you know, Nikola has none of those concerns. Like, you don't have to worry about closing your factory if you don't have any.
Yeah, he's got all these headaches. And
yeah,
all these, he's got to put all these fires with employees and COVID. Why deal with it?
Yeah, if you just make up a story and you're worth $30 billion at one point on nothing. Well, I would argue that all the people that think they're benefiting from that are fooling themselves.
Yeah,
this is a terrible thing that they're doing, and it's going to affect everybody. And most of them, actually, if you press them, are patriots. They love America. They may be immigrants themselves. They're self-made people. They enjoy their wealth. They probably give a lot to charity. They view themselves as good people. They need to stop and think, do I really need that extra $10 million or $100 million or $1 billion? If it comes at the expense of the complete and utter destruction of the capitalist society that we built that worked so well for so many people for so long. It is terrible what's happening today. And I get it, stock price, bro, I'm dead wrong. You know, you're a gold bug. I get it. It's wrong. It's immoral. It's not a great way to live. Life is about more than just money. And we are all collectively going to pay a price for what's going on in the market today. And I believe it firmly in my soul.
We are. I would go so far as we are. If you look at the rioting, if you look at the looting, this is the price we're paying for the financial shenanigans that have been going on for the last 20, the last 15, the last 10 years. And it's only going to get worse if the economy continues to deteriorate. and if asset prices, the stock market, continues to go up and food prices continue to go up, the cost of living goes up, that's not a good combination at all. But I want to go ahead, and I know you've been very generous with your time. I appreciate it. I want to have you kind of try to wrap things up in what you're doing with your own portfolio to position yourself in a way that's most prudent over the long term, and then maybe some takeaways for the average Joe and Jane. And that said, Mr. Charts, you've said a couple times here that you get some feedback or some pushback on Twitter with people giving you a hard time because you've been on the wrong side of Tesla. And for those types of people, I want to try to articulate my view on that just as quickly as I can. And for me, that's like being at a blackjack table and someone right next to you has a 19. And you tell them, listen, I would stay on a 19. And they're like, oh, what are you talking about? You're a gold bug. You're just an Austrian. You're too worried that the Fed's got my back. So then that person hits and gets a 2. So did they make the right decision or the wrong decision? Well, I would argue they made the wrong decision, even though they won the hand and got a blackjack. So if that person gets up, they spike the ball, in your face, George, in your face, Mr. Charts. Look at this. If I would have listened to you, I would have missed out on all of these gains. Well, that's correct, but over the short term. But over the long term, mathematically, they are going to go bust because they're going against the probabilities. So even though you might have been on the wrong side of the trade with Tesla for the last 2 years or whatever, call it, if you're always betting on the probabilities, assuming you're not doing it with your entire portfolio and you've got multiple bets out there, over the long run, you're going to be far ahead of the person that's just rolling the dice every time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say, you know, lots to unpack, and it's something I've given a lot of thought to, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss it. So first of all, I would never give investment advice. I'm not a registered investment advisor. My situation is unique from everyone else who's listening. All of those disclaimers up front and now to the side. I'm in a different situation than the average person. I had a very successful career in the corporate world. I have means. I have some degree of wealth that I've accumulated through my own hard work, good luck, privilege, some might say, however you want to describe it. I have enough money that if the current environment sort of persists, I don't really need to worry about working. And I'm very thankful for that. I'm very grateful for that. I grew up very poor. That wasn't always the case. I worked very hard. I'm proud of what I did. I'm proud of the money I've accumulated. I have a family that I love. I have business partners that I care deeply about. But by and large, I'm in a position in life where I'm much more concerned about wealth preservation than I am about wealth accumulation.
Right.
And to the extent that your audience is probably pretty well off and many of the listeners might be in that position, I'm personally very interested in accumulating real assets.
Okay.
And things that do well in an inflationary environment as a hedge. So even if inflation never shows up and the inflation boogeyman doesn't happen, and by some miracle, the constant unrelenting expansion of the M2 money supply never manifests itself in price. I'm okay to buy a little insurance against that. You know, my analogy would be I pay for home insurance every year, and every year that my house doesn't burn down, I'm not unhappy.
Right, right.
And so I have a pretty large investment in multiple year out leaps in gold, GLD, FIZ. You can't buy options on FIZ, but I own a lot of FIZ. I have some call options on GLD, and I own a ton of gold physical, and I own a ton of real things. Like I own my home, and I own land, and I own a lot of Rolex watches because I'm a big watch fan, and I happen to think watches are a great hedge against inflation because there's a ton of value in a small amount of weight. And Rolexes are sort of universal, and they're desirable in the same way that art is and paintings are. And so I'm not in art and in paintings because I don't know the space, but I know watches really well. So I have an allocation of my net worth towards real assets that are in of themselves hedges against inflation.
Okay. What do you think of Bitcoin?
I'm not in Bitcoin. I don't understand it. So one of my rules is if I don't understand it, I can't buy it.
Okay.
Gold has been 5,000 years money, and that's good enough for me. To me, you know, buying electrons and some key that I might lose is far less comforting. But again, I'm in a position where I've accumulated enough, especially relative to how I grew up. And then the second part of that coin is I've created a life where I can be happy all day at a very little cost.
Right.
And so my biggest advice to people who might be listening that are maybe have accumulated some wealth is the best NPV investment you could make is creating a life where you're happy and it's cheap. You don't need to live in New York City or Singapore or London to be happy. There's all kinds of great places to live in this country where it's very cheap to live, especially with high-speed internet, Bloomberg Terminal, Zoom, you know, Skype video as we're talking to each other right now. You're in Colombia. I'm in the Midwest, flyover country in the U.S. We're friends now. We've talked to each other like we're in the same room. I don't need to live in Manhattan to be happy. So right. The biggest investment you could make to preserve your wealth is to create a life where you are happy all day at minimal cost. And that actually is a very deeply philosophical question, which is, what do I need to be happy? I get to see my kids every day. It's the reason I left the corporate world. I could have stayed in the corporate world on autopilot and become much wealthier than I am today. What's the cost? I have dinner with my kids every day. I see my wife every day. I travel much less. I get to be Tesla charts, to interact with people like you. I host a great podcast, TC Starcast, with my business partner, Georgia Orwell. I've never been happier. And what's the value of that? And so to me, you know, my own personal portfolio is hedges against inflation with some income producing investments, but predominantly real assets. And then most importantly, controlling my budget so that I can be as happy as I can be without having to worry about keeping up with the Joneses. So I drive a Chevy Volt. That Chevy Volt cost me $26,000. I've had it for a year and a half, and I put 8,000 miles on it. I'm going to drive that thing until it gets to 100,000 miles, and it's going to cost me nothing. Right. I don't need the expensive German sports car to show off the neighbors. I got a car that I like to drive. It's dirt cheap, and I'm happy. Mm-hmm. And I got a finite amount of time on this planet, and so my strongest advice to your listeners is, what is your return on time? That's the only asset that we can't get any more of.
Yeah, for sure. And that's exactly why I retired in 2012. It's your story is very similar to mine. So on that note, in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and leave it there. Mr. Charts, for any of my viewers or listeners who want to find out more about what you do, I know you're kind of incognito, but where should they go? Should they just follow you on Twitter?
Sure. So the easiest way is to follow me at Tesla Charts. I should say there are, because I think because I'm effective, there's dozens of fake Tesla Charts account. Make sure you're following the real one. It's the account with, you know, 28,000 followers, not any of these fake accounts. But the project I'm most passionate about, and if you don't mind, maybe I'll give it a little commercial for you.
Yeah, please.
Is the podcast that I do, TC's Chartcast. We're through 30 episodes together. My co-host is Georgia Orwell. Our sound engineer is Evacuation Boy. We have an in-house poet, Poles Tesla. TC's Chartcast is my real passion project. Think of it as NPR for short sellers and skeptics and sort of hard money Austrian types. It's inspired by QTR, our mutual friend, Chris Irons. If Chris is a bit more blue in his podcast, we're sort of the more long-form, sophisticated, intelligent discourse. And there's a space for both of us. And Chris, I've been on Chris's show for a long time, and I'm very grateful for him and the support he's shown our podcast. But TC's Chartcast, find it on Apple iTunes and all of the major platforms. You won't regret it. It's a podcast for our guests, and we've had a great lineup of guests, and it's one of the funnest things that I do. So I appreciate the opportunity to give it a little pitch on your show.
Absolutely, guys. You got to check it out. So Mr. Charts, thank you again, and I cannot wait to do this in the future.
Anytime, my friend. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, Check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.